coming up on the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Today we're keeping an eye on the state budget. We hear Ag Secretary Karen Ross's comments to a state Senate budget committee. And we also hear more from this week's meeting on the situation at the ports. But we start today with Tech Thursday. Here's Taylor Chalstrom.
Our guest today is Luca Brillante, assistant professor in the Department of Viticulture and Enology at CSU Fresno, and we'll be discussing a carbon isotope discrimination tool for assessing grapevine water status during ripening. Welcome, Luca.
Thank you very much, Taylor, for having me. Excited to be here with you today.
Yeah, great to have you here. Luca, my first question for you here. You recently collaborated with other researchers to develop a carbon isotope discrimination tool that can serve as an alternative to traditional measurements of water status. How and why was this tool developed?
Yes, we have done a great effort in trying to calibrate this measurement to California conditions. It is a measurement that is well known in the plant biology world, but it has a very nice advantage for using fruit crops and specifically in grapevine is that with a few drops of juice from the berries, you can actually obtain the story of the water status during the full ripening process. And, you know, we know that water is a scarce resource, and especially this year after a couple winter of drought, we already know that there have been water cuts, and we need to be efficient in the use of this resource. So this tool is a chemical analysis that is similar to measuring bricks in the sense that it's done on the juice of berries, and then we use a different apparatus. But it gives us, as a biodata logger, of the water status of the grapevines during the full ripening period. And so it gives us an idea if that portion of a vineyard was overwatered, didn't have water enough, and can help us creating maps of water status that we can correlate to our current understandings.
Okay. And in the development of this tool, was there any ideas of possibly using it on a crop besides grapevine?
Not for our specific work. It was really focused on grapevine, but the tool can be used for other crops. It's very well used in cereals and is done on grains. I'm not aware of other specialty crops that will be more interesting to us. I know that has been tried in walnuts. It will definitely work as well in almonds, but I don't know where actually measuring it. In the grapes, it's straightforward because it's a measurement based on the sugars. And in grapes, we have roughly 25% of sugars by weight at harvest. And so it's very easy to separate them. We just evaporate the water. You know, we put the juice in a oven, and then what remains is mostly sugars. And so we can have access to that. But I definitely think that can be expanded because the reason of functioning are very fundamental from a biological point of view. And they are just related to how the leaves works. And when the stomata are open, we have a specific kind of carbon in the sugars. When the stomata are closed, we have a different kind of carbon in the sugars. These are the two isotopes that give the name to the technique. And then we just are able enough to measure these small differences between the kind of carbons that compose the sugars and that are accumulated into the end crop. So in this case, the sugar of the grapes, or in the case of cereals or wheat, in the grains. And I would imagine that in almonds as well, it could be measured into the fruit or the seeds in some way.
Okay. Luca, what are the features and benefits of this isotope discrimination tool?
The benefit is that you do not need to measure multiple times the water status of the plants in order to have an idea of what is the average condition for that location. So let's say it's easy to have to look backward and understand what has happened to that, or at least collect an historical an history of the water use from that block or that specific collection of vines, because he's able to integrate the water stages during the full ripening process. Because every time that the sugar molecules gets accumulated into the berries, and then this happens for like 1 month and a half during production of grapes, then this signal is recorded. And then we are able to understand what have been the average conditions. So let's take an analog. If I do this with a pressure bomb, in order to have a good average conditions of waters, the water status for that linear block, I need to measure this more than once during the season, one time, two times, but more likely, most likely 4 to 5 times at least to have a good average, one times per week, one times every 2 weeks. Now, the good things of the pressure bomb is that it helps you in scheduling the water. You right away understand if you're giving too much or you are not giving enough. This tool, since that, it just gives you an average of what has been the full story of the water status of that location or for that vines. And so it's very useful for understanding if you're scheduling has been correct or not appropriate enough. If you want to map over large surfaces the use of water by the plants, it's much easier to do this with a measurement that can be done on a fruit sample and is not time dependent. You can collect them at any time during the morning, the evening, the afternoon, will not be affected. And you can do this over multiple days without really changing too much the average conditions. Well, for the pressure bomb, you are very limited to a couple hours during the central part of the day in order to be consistent. And then you need to go multiple times, which makes this impossible over large surfaces with large sampling point. So what we suggest to do with this tool is starting integrating this into classical ripening measurements. You know, everybody goes out there and samples fruits and measure Brix, pH, TA. Then you can just add this measurement and also have an idea of what has been the average water stress for that fruit, for the vines that produce that fruits, and understanding if from this data, understanding if you could improve your water scheduling or if there is a relationship between having a low water stress or high water stress and certain fruit composition that you may want to favor in your fruit production.
Okay. So it's kind of sounding like this particular method compared to more traditional methods like the pressure bomb, it may offer growers some additional benefits in terms of time savings, maybe labor savings, and possibly even cost savings as well. Am I incorrect in assuming that?
It definitely will help into saving the time that you need for pressure bombing. At the same time, is not for scheduling. What it will help you is addressing cost saving in the sense that you may understand, let's say you irrigate in the same way a block of 80 acres, right? Or 60 acres. And they are all in the same pipes. And then you irrigate all of that as one block. Eventually, you realize that by measuring these measurements, this by measuring the carbon content of these fruits in different locations of the vineyards, you realize that there is a portion of the vineyard that got too much water and a portion of the vineyard that didn't get enough. And eventually, you start considering that you may split the irrigation in two sides. Instead of having a 60-acre block all at once, you may split in 30 acres and 30 acres and irrigate these a little bit differentially, but saving a lot of water and money in the long term. And especially right now that, of course, the water has been limited by so much, you need to understand where you put your resources. And so you would like to favor the ones that will need the most. And having an idea, a baseline of understanding how variable is in space, your water stress for your crop may help addressing more precisely where you need to water and how much. And to have like a picture of what is the water stress across the full estate, with this tool is fairly easy and straightforward, and it's not an indirect measurement. You know, it's not like remote sensing that measure other things and then relate that to water. You are actually measuring the physiology of the plant. So you're actually having an idea of if that water is being used or not. And so it's already ground truthed and very much related to the true conditions.
Okay. Luca, the results of the project you were working on for this tool found that the isotope discrimination tool is a reliable and repeatable assessor of plant water status and gas exchange in vineyard systems. How were those results quantified?
What we did is we selected four different vineyards from the North Coast to the San Joaquin Valley, table grapes vineyard, as well wine grapes vineyards, different varieties. And we start monitoring the grapevine water status with traditional means. You know, we did a lot of pressure bombings across multiple seasons and multiple locations. And then for all places where we did our pressure bomb measurements, we also collected fluid to measure this this indicator. And finally, we correlated these traditional measurements, you know, pressure bomb, gas exchange, you know, with the barometers and so on, at the scientific level, defined measurements. And we correlated with the with this indicator, and we found that the correlation were outstanding. I mean, they are very tight. There is very little noise into the correlation, and this helps us indirectly transforming this carbon isotope discrimination value, which is a very hard name to pronounce, into something that is much more telling to people. And we can transform this into average pressure bomb measurement, so that we know that if the carbon isotope as that value, that corresponds to minus 10 bars of pressure bond. And that translation makes the tool much more useful to the average grower, because speaks in the same language that we are used to speak every day when and with the tools that we normally use for water assessment.
So the tool is presenting growers essentially the similar, if not the same data as a pressure bomb, just in a much, I guess, more compacted way, if you will?
Yes. Let's say it's like going out there with the pressure bomb and measuring your water stress every single second of the vine life during the ripening period. So instead of, and then taking all these, you know, thousands of pressure bomb measurements and doing like an average of all of them. And with this tool, you basically, with this chemical measurement, you have the same information as doing, again, 1,000 pressure bombs every single second of grapevine life during the ripening period, and get that number at the end of the season. Now, if you think that that number is meaningful to you, then there is, of course, no reason to collect 1,000 pressure bomb measurement. You can just take a few drops of juice and you have the same information.
Okay. Luca, my last question for you here. How can growers, you know, acquire a tool like this and use it in their vineyards? You know, what does that tool look like for them?
For the growers, this is some analysis that you will do with an external lab because the machinery involved is very expensive and very complicated. We're talking about couple hundred thousand dollars of machinery involved for measuring these. And that makes sense for, you know, nothing else that is a chemical lab, not for the growing conditions. But so how the growers would use this is, again, you measure your pricks, your pH, your TA, or on your fruit. And then this will definitely works on all fruit with juice in the same way. You extract the juice from the fruits, And you send the juice to the lab, a lab like us. We do also this for other, you know, for growers if they're interested into. And we process this juice and give the data back to you. The analysis is fairly cheap. Does not, apart the machinery, doesn't really involve higher cost in supplies and things like that. And considering that it's a measurement you do at the end of the season to understand what has happened, normally you can also expect not an extremely quick turnaround time, because it's something that you use for understanding the previous season and plan the next one. It's not something that you really need for a timely management the next day. So this also lowered the cost in the end of the measurement, which is in roughly between $15 and $20, depending on the lab.
Okay. Well, Luca, that is some great information about this new tool for measuring plant water stress. It definitely sounds like a promising alternative to some of the more traditional methods, such as a pressure bomb. We appreciate you coming on and chatting about it today.
Thank you very much, Taylor. It was a pleasure to be with you all, guys. And thank you for following this podcast. I hope to be here with you again in the future.
Definitely. Thank you. This is Taylor Charlstrom reporting for the My Ag Life Daily News Report.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Here's your news brief for today. From the California Farm Bureau, amid discussions about how much river flow needs to be dedicated to fish, an ongoing study indicates predators eat half or more of protected salmon regardless of flow levels. A fishery consulting firm working on the lower Stanislaus River says bass and other fish eat many juvenile salmon and that the losses don't appear connected to flows in the river. A state plan would require more water to remain in rivers and therefore unavailable for human use. Land sales activity was flat the past few years, but that may soon change. The lower supply of farms for sale has been one of the factors that supported land values after the 2013 peak in prices paid for ag land. Farmers National Company reports seeing indications for increased land sale activity through to the end of 2021. Farmers National Company and its agents have already received an increased number of calls from landowners who are thinking about selling later in the year. With cherry harvest beginning in the San Joaquin Valley, marketers say they expect a large crop of high quality and that people who pick and pack the cherries will be protected against the pandemic. The California Cherry Board says farmers and packers have worked to vaccinate their employees and that safeguards inaugurated last season remain in place. The California cherry harvest will continue through mid-June. Dairy Management, Inc. has entered in a partnership that will provide access to a network of inventors and entrepreneurs. That network is tasked with providing marketplace solutions for industry challenges focused on health and sustainability. DMI is partnering with Venture Winston Grants, which has designated a competition where startup companies can apply for funding that will allow them to incorporate dairy into their concepts in one of four areas. Those areas include health and nutrition, bio-based products, smart communities of the future, and regenerative agriculture. The Agriculture Secretary took to the podium on the daily White House press briefing Wednesday to give an update on efforts to reduce hunger in our nation. Here is Secretary Tom Vilsack.
I'm here primarily to talk about food and nutrition security, and you may think that that is just about food and nutrition security, but in fact, it's about a lot more than that. When you understand that 25% of America's workforce is directly or indirectly impacted by the food and ag industry, that it represents a significant percentage of our GDP, that educational achievement is somewhat dependent on youngsters having healthy and nutritious food as they begin their school year and school day, and the fact that it is a noted effort at reducing poverty, food and nutrition security becomes an important issue. And certainly we've seen the impact of that during the course of the pandemic. When the American Rescue Plan was enacted, hunger in the United States was at 14% of our population, which was an incredibly high number. Today, as a result of the investments under the American Rescue Plan, we now know that hunger has dipped to 8% of America's population. That's a remarkable drop in a six-month period. It is a result of extending SNAP, as we did in the American Rescue Plan, creating a summer EBT program that will institute opportunities for nearly 30 million children to have access to nutrition during the summer months, increasing our commitment to WIC, and basically making a down payment, if you will, on hunger reduction. We have the opportunity over the course of the next several months, as Congress considers the American Job Plan and the American Family Plan, to cement those results and to actually build upon them. There are three key investments for nutrition and food security in the American Families Plan. First, we are going to make permanent this incredible and historic effort to feed kids during the summer months. There are, as I said, nearly 30 million American children who are in free and reduced lunch status in schools. At the end of the school year, there is no program other than a summer feeding program, which impacted and affected several million of those 30 million children. Now we have the opportunity to provide each one of these families with a card that looks like this. This is the summer EBT card. That's available. It allows parents the opportunity to go to the grocery store as they do with their SNAP card and be able to purchase additional fruits and vegetables and other wholesome food for their children, ensuring that 30 million kids will have the opportunity to have nutrition during the summer, which means that they'll be better prepared to begin school ready to learn in the fall. We're also extending with this effort the opportunity to impact free school meals in high poverty school areas by focusing on the community eligibility program that essentially identifies the ability of a school district where SNAP participation is roughly 40% to extend free meals to everyone in that school. This is going to expand opportunities for youngsters to be well fed, and we know from a recent Tufts study that one of the healthiest places in the country for children to eat is now in America's schools. So we're going to see that extended, and we're going to focus with a specific laser-like focus on elementary schools to make sure that our youngest learners have the best possible opportunity. And finally, we're going to invest $1 billion with Congress's help and assistance in trying to figure out strategies that will improve even more than we already have the nutritional value and quality of the meals that youngsters receive in schools. So these three steps, these three key investments on the American Families Plan will allow us to cement the gains under the American Rescue Plan and hopefully impact and reduce hunger to the point eventually one day where we won't have to have a press conference about hunger.
That's your news brief for today. State Ag budget discussions are next. We'll be right back.
Agrimiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agrimiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpak R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agrimiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpak 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on the every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Agriculture, pesticides, and regulations took center stage at the State Budget Subcommittee hearing this week. California Department of Food and Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross spoke at the State Senate Agriculture Budget Plan hearing. Here are her remarks.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, and thank you. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. Jared shows great proficiency in understanding the very complex agricultural system. So I don't want to be repetitive, but I do want to call on two things. One is the role of agricultural commissioners. It is unique to the state of California, and I think having that local arm of a regulatory agency has been a huge contributor to the success of agriculture during the continual adaptation that it's done. And especially when it comes to new regulatory programs, they oftentimes are the sponsors of SprayStake and other opportunities to make sure that the regulated community understands what the new regulations are, what the changes are, and how to operationalize that. So they are very important partners for us, and I just wanted to call out their role because it is unique to the state of California. Secondly, we have lost over the last two decades in particular significant funding to the University of California specific to the Agricultural and Natural Resources Division, which is oversees cooperative extension, and the institutions that are housed on campuses with specialists who do the research, who create the content and the knowledge, and give us what we need to build out programs. But what makes the cooperative extension system such a value proposition is the translation of those research findings to the end user in a very practical way in their region, in their crop. They oftentimes are doing field trials to be able to show what's possible. And being able to invest in that on a continual basis will make a difference. It's lost that funding. The IPM program has lost significant funding over the last 15 years. We also lost funding for the bio-integrated farming systems, which is a small grant program that we run. And I would also say it's important for the state of California for the invasive pest programs that we operate at the Department of Food and Agriculture. We oftentimes, when there is a new pest, we are developing the cutting edge IPM approach to dealing with those infestations. And we constantly are looking to our partners at UC Cooperative Extension. The role of CSU is especially important because they are educating the next generation of pest control advisors and pest managers within farming operations. So being able to provide them a steady stream of funding that they can use to make sure they've got boots on the ground with personnel, in addition to being able to do the research on campus, we believe will make this a very robust program and truly assist in supporting the transition of agriculture to meet the multiple demands from the marketplace, as well as the regulatory issues that we have with pesticides. And I appreciate the opportunity to make those comments.
Secretary, could you enlighten me on the DNA barcode reference, the Library of California? Once this reference library is completely built out, how might it help us and future leaders?
Yeah. So it's a very exciting proposal. I was thrilled to see my friends working on something like this, and it reminded me of what we've worked on so hard over the years to do seed banking. With our new diagnostic tools and the new ability to sequence the genetics, this will help us better understand what's in our ecosystems, how it's moving, and I believe it can help us identify invasive pests earlier, but also track how our pollinators are moving and where their declines are as we really work in new partnerships with the industry on pollinator health. It will inform our programs that are very important to the state of California. We do extensive trapping and look for all kinds of tools to exclude invasive pests. But Secretary Blumenfeld is exactly right. We are seeing new invasive pests. We're seeing them here for longer seasons. And so we believe that the merits of this will inform our programs, excuse me, in a very practical way. And what has been proposed, as I understand it, will also make this rich database of genetic material available for academia and for farmers and ranchers. We have some of the best entomologists, not only in the nation, but we have some world-renowned experts at our plant diagnostics lab. And we see this as being a very helpful tool for our work as the state of California, in addition to continued research and protection of our pollinators and biodiversity hotspot that California is.
Secretary Ross, given that rich urban-rural history of California, do you see that at some time that even urban California would be able to get information about which species pollinate which plant and which eats what pest, that there may be some communications to suburbia, but this is the type of plant that you want to put in your backyard because it's going to attract this pest, which is going to eat this bad invasive species or something like that? I mean, is that where we end up with this?
Yeah, definitely,
library?
Because there are these databases that are housed at several of our university and academia partners. I will call out in particular the role of Cooperative Extension, which has personnel in every county in the state, and an extensive makeup of citizen scientists and master gardeners who work specifically on these kinds of things. So the more information we have to be able to arm them with that information and teaching the right plants in the right place and how to do the lowest impact pest management possible, this is the type of information that can be used through that system of people that are out there doing community outreach to gardeners, to golf courses, and to urban landscapers, a very important audience in this particular situation.
Well, I know there must be some people in suburbia that realize that, as our staff report points out, a 99% decline in monarch butterflies since 1980 in the last 40 years. And if they knew what type of plant they should put in it when they go to Home Depot, wherever they go, the plant shop, it might be good information.
Secretary Karen Ross. Up next, we have continuing coverage of the problem at the ports. We will be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
The California State Board of Food and Agriculture Tuesday discussed challenges and opportunities related to port congestion, with a special emphasis on agricultural exports. The board heard from port officials and agricultural stakeholders, as well as trucking, maritime, and retail industry representatives. We heard opening statements in yesterday's show. Here's part of the question and answer session. We start with board member Eric Holst asking a question of Weston LaVar of the Harbor Trucking Association.
Don, I'll jump in with the question. This is Eric. I think my question is for Weston. I've been fascinated with this presentation. I don't know a lot about ports, so everything that you guys have talked about is basically new information for me. So my quick question on the trucking side of this: what is the business structure? Are these big trucking companies that hired drivers? Are they independent drivers that own their own equipment? What's the mix there?
Yes, all of the above. So there's a lot of unknowns right now, obviously, going on in California, which has kind of made it difficult for folks to figure out what the path forward is from business model. Most historically, 80%+ of the labor force would be owner operators who own their own trucks and contract with trucking companies. There's basically three designations. You've got your employee drivers, which is a very small portion of the industry, quite frankly. You've got your 1099 independent contractors, which made up the majority of it until recently. And those folks were dedicated to one trucking company under federal FMCSA labor law. They had to lease that truck for 120 consecutive days or more to one licensed motor carrier, aka trucking company, which unfortunately in many cases is incongruent with California labor policy. And then what we've seen is the rapid growth, because we do have such a blue collar entrepreneurial industry, of the sub haulers. So those are W-9, basically fully autonomous motor carriers who are there to work with larger motor carriers to relieve the surges and create more capacity. I would say still the majority of the market operates in those final two segments. I think moving, transitioning more from that 1099 to that W-9 model. And part of that, I will tell you, is because as we work with drivers, many of them have no interest in being an employee. So when you convert your business model, they go someplace else. They've invested in a truck. They want to own their own business. And the maturation in our industry usually goes from employee to 1099 contractor to W-9 subhauler to maybe large motor carrier. Some of the largest motor carriers started with one guy driving one truck and contracting for free. So with that, we feel like a big part of making the system work correctly is not draconian labor policy that California is trying to push, but however, again, virtual integration, creating easy opportunities, using artificial intelligence to connect the right drivers with the right loads and try to make the system work more efficiently so you don't ever have bobtails, essentially truck driving with nothing behind it. And that's a great way to increase efficiency, and it's a great way to increase income for these owner operators that are out there trying to start their own business. But I hope that answers your question. But right now with AB5 in the court systems and with that I guarantee is going to go to the Supreme Court, with the PRO Act in Congress right now, which is a replication of AB5 at the federal level with an ABC test. There's a lot of unknowns, but I can tell you that the industry and the drivers in the industry are not interested in being re-regulated and being part of a central union dispatch.
And now board member Andy Thulin asks a question of Gene Soroka, the California Association of Port Authorities and the Port of Los Angeles, also asking of Weston Labar.
I think this is probably a question for Gene. First of all, great presentations. And like myself, I'm just learning about this area. But recently I was told by a researcher here on campus that the containers coming in, maybe it cost them from China, maybe $6,000 per container, $5,000, whatever it is. But to go back, it's $500 because they need to get that throughput quicker from Asia. And his comment to me was this a few weeks ago that, you know, it's not worth their time to send those containers to the valley to get filled up with some ag product and then ship back because of the demurrage of the time or the time that, it, you know, they would be offline. So do you have any sense of that, Gene?
Yeah, this has been, Commissioner, this has been an age-old question for all the years that I've been in the industry. We've been an import-dominated market for the better part of five decades now. We've outsourced much of our manufacturing to Asia. And when it works very well. But how do we as an industry cater to the American exporter? Typically, our imports go to major metropolitan areas where many of us live in America and buy, shop. Our exports traditionally come from rural America, whether it be the farming sector, manufacturing broadly, even automotive and their tiered suppliers. California is no different. Central Valley comes to mind right away. So we've been working on, and I used these terms earlier, round trip and triangulated economics. It's no more than this. Bring an import to the country, have it move domestically to a rural area, and then have that rural area load up that container back to Asia. We've got to, and I mean this with all sincerity from all my years in business, both here and overseas, we've got to find a value proposition for the California exporter. We all know that there's value, but we have to show that value to the asset provider, the transportation company, the shipping company. I've got some ideas, but it's going to take more than just me throwing a couple things out. We need some real input from the experts here on this call, including the secretary. We need some real input from the producers, the growers, the farmers. to find out how we can create that value proposition, because it's there. And we have to convince folks on how we can route cargo a little bit better as an industry. For example, we have a ton of cargo that comes inbound to the state of California that goes to the East Bay, Sacramento Valley, and it's all finished goods that go to our distribution centers, our retailers. Again, think of Target and Walmart and all the stores that we shop at, plus many, many others of small and medium-sized variety in our neighborhoods. How can we take that international container and what we call street turn it so it's very close to the California farmer, whether it be in Merced County or points beyond? That, to me, will be the formula that we need to employ, but we need those others on board with us. Make sure the economics work. Make sure we can deliver the cargo as a state that we say we can at the time when we say we it will be ready. And match that up with these complex schedules of truck, rail, and vessel that seem to really complicate matters, especially in times that we face now in ship congestion at ports, because there's not one ship that's on time today. So if one of our exporters books against a ship that's supposed to leave this Saturday, it's probably not going to leave for another 7 days. Matching all of this up through advanced digitization, let the computers do the work, let the experts tell the computer how to do it. And I think that gives us a leg up to getting into this conversation of adding value. It's there, we simply have to extract it. But your numbers are roughly correct. And while some see it non-compensatory to move certain exports, whether it be here in the heartland of the country, the other piece is really around timing. And what we're seeing right now in this prolonged import surge that we've never witnessed before is that you've got so many backed up purchase orders at manufacturing plants in Asia that there is the view of some that we cannot spend the time getting that container out to a rural farm, waiting for it to be loaded, or a manufacturer or an auto plant for that matter, letting it come back to the West Coast, then shipping it overseas, bringing it out to a rural community for emptying that container, then bring that empty back to the manufacturing plant. If the liner shipping companies can cut off those two ends, we call them the advanced and beyond transportation, it takes a lot less time to get that container back for the next round of imports. And that's what these guys and ladies fundamentally are seeing right now. So there's got to be a little bit of a balance here. There's going to be some risk-taking. We've got to show the value and get really succinct on all these transit times. An empty reposition from LA up to Bakersfield, and then how quickly we can turn that container back and get it on a ship and go into Asia. We've got to be a lot more precise as an industry, and that's going to take the really big help of our mutual customer.
Yeah. Gene, if I could just add on to that too, because it's interesting when you speak with our ag exporters versus non-ag exporters, especially ones that are located in urban areas. They don't deal with some of the same challenges because of their close proximity to the port. It's easier to do things like street turning containers. As I talked, local land use policy needs to be part of this equation. I think this is where you all can have a voice, but we need to be able to, when the way we use transload from an import side to try to keep the container close to the port so you don't have excessive dwell time outside of the port, we need to better leverage transload on the export side to do the same thing, where we can bring those goods to the port and have a situation where imports are going into outbound intermodal or over the road trucks, and the exports are going from those trucks or containers into the ocean containers. We don't do, I think, a good job of balancing transload. And I've seen in Oakland where they do a much better job just because of the 50-50 makeup. These are things that we need to work with the port on. But a lot of it starts with making sure we have the land to be able to do it and do it in an efficient way. And like I said, we're seeing many challenges in the form of amortizing industrial property or the cannabis industry. I guess that's agricultural, but the cannabis industry gobbling up industrial space for growing and storage operations. And the difficulty getting conditional use permits or CEQA approvals for industrial projects. It's great that we want to fast light baseball stadiums and port authorities, but quite frankly, we need to be fast lighting the type of industrial facilities that are going to move our products and help American exporters out. And I just don't see that happening right now.
If there's a topic you'd like us to watch, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.